The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 4th of October, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Richard Holohan, CEO of Polarion. P-O-L-X is ticker there. And Richard covers the highlights from their half-year report, the progress on their Phase 3 clinical trials, and the recent announcements from their major shareholder. Also, I have Nick Tulloch, Chief Executive Officer of Zoetic International. Zoe is the ticker there. Nick provides the market with a trading update on the CBD business and the potential sale of their legacy oil and gas assets. Also, it's a Friday, so Glenn is here. Glenn Goodman, crypto trader, author, and we chat about the world of crypto, and we talk a lot of rubbish as well. Well, in fact, it's mainly rubbish. Probably a couple of facts in there. Also on the podcast at the end, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. I would, if I were you, check out both these lists every day. Highly important. Nothing more important than this. Get there first thing in the morning, okay? Before anything else. because I tell you why. The most followed companies, that's a measure of money flow, essentially. People are, you know, clicking on those companies, wanting to get their updates. They only do that because they're researching those companies or investing in those companies. So it's worth looking at. Also, we have top five most liked RNSs. And if you receive an RNS via the app is free to download. Go to the app stores. And if you get an RNS and you like the content about RNS, by all means, hit that thumbs up button within that RNS, and it may feature on this podcast and on the front page of voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Holohan, CEO of Polarion Imaging, as P-O-L-X ticker. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Now, there's a lot of interest building in the story because we are coming up to significant milestones. And, of course, the completion of enrollment and results after that of the Phase 3 trial. But before we dig into that and where you are and what's happening, for people not familiar yet with Polarion, could you just give them a summary, Richard, as to what it's all about, please?
Yes, absolutely. So we are what the regulatory world calls a drug-device combination. And by that, I mean we have equipment and we have a drug. So we have a polarizer and the inert noble gas xenon, which we polarize, and we turn that into a contrast agent, which is used in functional magnetic resonance imaging to explain pulmonary function to physicians. And of course, it's never been done before, and there is no competing technology that can explain the complete range of pulmonary function the way that our test can.
Yeah, and just to explain, you're towards the end of enrollment for patients, and then after that, of course, the Phase 3 trial will be complete. And it's essentially your tech, which is 3D, you know, high resolution, non-harmful to humans, against a 40-year-old tech that's radioactive and 2D. Is that the case?
Yes, that's exactly correct. The situation for a drug device combination in this case for us is what the regulatory folks call a non-inferiority head-to-head trial. So in contrast to classic pharma, where you have placebos and large squads of thousands of patients to prove a point, we're actually very focused, very concentrated. It's absolutely statistical and quantitative. It's head-to-head. The total trial is 80 patients in two indications, and we're just at the tail end of our Phase 3 trial here.
Yeah, like I said, compared to most, because we've had, you know, in the junior markets, you've had a couple of companies fail the last sort of Phase 3 clinical trial, and I've tried to explain to you, this is pretty much, I said, one of the most lowest risk Phase 3s I've ever come across, because, first of all, it's almost, you know, device against device, which is not, you're not testing on a human, because, like I said, you can test 10 different humans and get 10 different sort of results, so that's where it can be very sort of, you know, random elements and returns in those kind of Phase 3s. And also, like I said, you know, the number of patients you're testing is 80. Normally, Phase 3s can be several hundreds, can't it?
Oh, into the thousands, of course. Yeah. Ours is 80 at two sites. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other thing that's important about trials is that they be conducted by experts. And so the two sites are Duke, which is our home base from an R&D point of view, and the University of Virginia, which is our largest customer. They have multiple systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you announced your half-year report, you said enrollment for the clinical trials now passed 98% in the lung transplant pathway, 87% in the lung lobe resection pathway, a total of 80 patients. And you were expecting to complete this enrollment by the end of September. I've had a couple of people saying, What's happened? Yes, what's happened to the deadline? Yes. So what happened, Richard?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we ask ourselves that every morning. So the issue, of course, is when we say 98% and 87%, you have to then convert that into patients, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about patients that fit on one hand here. And the issue is simply the noise involved in the daily lives of patients. And so, for example, in the lung transplant case, we were scheduled to finish our penultimate patient in the trial when they got the call in the middle of the night on the day before our scan that they got their lungs. And so they had the transplant and we lost them from the trial. We were thrilled for them, sad for us, but that is kind of where we are in this process on a day-by-day, you know, patients on fingers kind of way. It's simply getting people to the institution and into the scanning techniques. And because, remember, these are going on at tertiary medical centers where people are traveling hundreds of miles for these procedures. So there is noise in the logistics of handling patients, noise in scheduling, and we're simply, now that the microscope is focused on the very tail end of this process, you see all of the noisy things that have actually been going on all during the trial anyway. They just didn't have such kind of immediate and conspicuous effects on completing the trial. But we're nearly there. We still have patients flowing in the institutions. There's been no change in any of the fundamentals here. It's simply getting the last couple of them through the gate and into the trial here.
So essentially, it's single-digit patients needed, and but it's just yes. It'll take what, weeks, months? What are you thinking?
Yeah, but we're looking at a couple of weeks here. I think we forecasted 3 weeks, being a little bit conservative. We're continuing to enroll, and it's frequently the case when you enroll someone who's actually just arrived in town and could be done the next day. And so people do jump the line in trials frequently. So I could hang up my call with you and find that I'm actually done. But we're budgeting right now to be done about the middle of October here.
Okay, and just to reiterate, after the last person is enrolled and they're tested, how long after that last patient is sorted will you conclude the phase three and get the results and top line results from that?
Yep. So there are two things. I think people are familiar with the term readout in a drug trial, and readout, of course, is the purely statistical analysis of the outcome of the trial. Because we're an imaging trial and in a head-to-head comparison, we have two components to our readout. The first component is reading, right? Because these are images and have to be read by a contracted clinician. And reading is actually already underway. So we've begun the reading process. Post the reading, it's then handed off to the statistical folks who then do the read out. Okay. So we're still holding firm to the idea that readout will happen before the end of the year here.
Okay. And one of the other questions I'm getting all the time is, of course, you release this, via RNSs, but to Amphion, your biggest shareholder, who's in financial difficulty, of course, and they have a loan and your shares are held there, they are selling every now and again, and it's knocking the share price, and it must be frustrating for you because you're a shareholder as well. I don't know what you can say on that because you've expressed what they've said in their RNSs, but is there anything you can elaborate on there?
Sure. And I think it's always useful to just step back and say this could be any investor. It happens to be unique because it's Amphion, but in fact, anyone could find themselves in this position. And so I think the selling, if you read the RNSs closely, it's not actually Amphion selling. It's the lender, right? The lender, these are collateral. They've been pledged. There are terms in the note that give them the right to do that under certain circumstances. And I think if you look at the daily volume, they are not a large percentage of our daily volume. So I think that's simply the case. There are some sales going on per the terms of that loan agreement, but it's not Amphion selling because they want to. We're a very important investment for them. They participate actively on our board enthusiastically, and this is just an unfortunate circumstance.
Yeah. I mean, they do say, like I said, in the last, RNS, they say, they're working hard trying to ensure the company does not have to sell more shares than is entirely necessary. We are excited by and steadfastly believe in the future prospects of Polarin and its important technologies. So you can see, they wouldn't have invested in the first place. But, I mean, that's how they stand. So they are reluctantly selling shares because they have to, I suppose, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody would do this if they didn't have to do it.
Yeah. Okay, let's just touch on some other highlights, if possible, Richard, from the interims. What are you proud of the last 6 months? And going forward, we'll look at that as well.
Yeah, I think two things I will say. The good news about the highlights, and I know they're half-year results, but I always draw together the highlights and the post-period notes to kind of get a more full picture of what's going on in the company. Everyone understands that because our top line is driven by equipment sales to grant recipients, grants are notoriously noisy, and we are seldom, if ever, wrong on the number of them that we will get or accomplished, but it's frequently difficult to get them bucketed in things like financial quarters. So on occasion, we over and under the number because they're so small. But the good news is for this year, to plan, I think we're very happy with the continued flow of orders from some very high-end academic institutions in medical imaging, including the Kansas and British Columbia guys you'll see. You'll also notice that we're selling additional equipment to early customers, the Sick Kids facility in Toronto, which is one of the world's luminary research facilities in cystic fibrosis. So very happy about the metrics of the business. You can tell also from looking at the expense line, we're being very frugal with the money that we've raised. We're on plan for expense, most of which is dominated for us by the trial. And I think just happy I think the other title that you could put on the half-year report is doing what we said we would do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And just explain to people, let's say the phase three is successful, and what happens next, and how does that change? For example, for most people not in the medical field may think, well, what's the difference between having, selling to a research industry or for research purposes and it being a fully commercial sale? So how does that differ?
Yeah, so simply selling to the research sites is a regulatory allowance for sites that themselves do research, right? Commercial sales are simply healthcare industry sales to institutions for the purpose of treating patients, period, right? So we're pre-approval, and so by definition, none of these institutions are charging anyone for this service, even if they're evaluating clinical patients in the context of their research, which is almost always the case here. So post-FDA approval, then this gets more ordinary, and we're simply dealing, instead of with the award of grants, we're simply dealing with capital budgeting processes in major universities and hospitals.
Okay. And looking forward, like I said, if everything goes to plan now, where do you see, Polarin in say, 12 months' time, if you can? How far down this commercial route could you be?
Yeah, so the timeline for the FDA's approval, if you remember, there are two things going on here. Mm-hmm. One is we are submitting to the drug side of the drug device combination regulatory entity. So we're submitting to what the FDA calls CDER, which is the drug side of all of this. And two things are true. One is the allowable time from a regulatory point of view for the review of a new drug application is 10 months. But if you remember from our investment case presentations, we're also looking for Hatch-Waxman protection in the U.S. And Hatch-Waxman is the regulatory grant of market exclusivity for 5 years post-approval. And so that is associated with, you could think of it as a companion or appendix to the new drug application, specifically about the creation of an NCE, new chemical entity associated with this, which would be our contrast agent, the hyperpolarized xenon. So if you submit an NCE along with your NDA, and we'll have to have a decoder ring for acronyms here if we're not careful, then they get an additional 60 days to consider your submission. So the total all in there is 12 months.
Mm, okay. And just for people that are not, say hearing the podcast for the first time, what's the potential market here?
You know, I think we try to, it's hard to say. I think if you're serving in business marketing parlance, if you're serving a market, then you have market statistics and you calculate what the size of those markets are. If you're creating a market, it's a little harder, right? There is no survey that I could buy that would tell me what the market for this is. So we create these, I guess we would call them suspension systems, where we try to peg the corners of some geometric shape that defines what the range of values for this market might be. So on the one corner of our shape, we would say, well, this is an accessory for MR machines. It requires an MR machine to be used, and the global installed base for MR machines, N equals something like 35,000, right? We've made no secret of the fact in our investment presentations that for the first several years of the business, we will be selling directly into the high end of academic teaching hospitals and medicine. And in the U.S., there are something on the order of 11,000 or so kind of institutions. The area of the top of that pyramid that we're targeting is something like 100 to 200, 700 to 1,000 bed hospitals associated with universities. And in our business model and in the research notes that have been published, both independently and by our broker, you would see that despite the massive scale of all of that, our target is 100, right? To get this technology deployed in the very top of that pyramid. And then while we do that and develop the clinical applications and develop all of the underpinning go-withs for this, I think we would, of course, be working in the background, making machines designed for commodity markets and global markets that were smaller, better, faster, cheaper, kind of a very classic approach to the high end of medical imaging. This looks very much like the rollout of CT and magnetic resonance imaging themselves to markets, which went exactly this way.
Wow, marvelous stuff. Okay, Richard, one final thing, as always, if someone's listening, likes the sound of this and the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
I will. So you can tell by looking at the RNSs and listening to our podcast here that this is a story of a company who makes assertions about what their objectives are and then executes them. So we're doing what we said we would do. You can see that not only in our clinical trial, which is a head-to-head non-inferiority trial, but also based on the fact that the company is built on a prior investment by a large company. For in terms of de-risking an investment opportunity, we've de-risked the regulatory side of this and de-risked the R&D side of this, which are the two big risks in most of these kinds of things, to a large degree, right? Coming in now, you would be benefiting from the sum of some $50 to $60 million of R&D expense already spent in getting this technology to this point. And then finally, the research notes make it very clear that I think we have been very, very conservative about market entry strategies, and that there are significant upsides, not only in other clinical applications. We're now showing cardiology in addition to all permanent pulmonary medicine ones, but also in geographic markets. Just the very simple concept of opening the European markets, the Asian markets, which probably dwarf the sum of the U.S. and European markets, just tremendous upside in terms of the future for the business. Yeah. Those are the three.
Yeah, and well, you should add that you hold shares in the company, and of course, Bassinda's as well. So the board have a nice chunk of skin in the game, don't they?
Yes, we do. I mean, we're in it. You know, we could be an app, and we could have hired a bunch of people from Silicon Valley to do this. We're not. If you look at the management team, it's a bunch of guys who have only ever done this. Right, I've been in MR since it was invented. Bastiana has been hyperpolarizing noble gases since he invented it. We are committed to the technology and to getting this into the hands of patients and doctors, and that's why we get up in the morning.
Marvelous stuff. Good to chat to you as always, Richard, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin. Have a good day.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nick Tulloch, Chief Executive Officer of Zoetic International. Zoe is ticker there, Z-O-E. Nick, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and you've released a trading update. And when I last looked, the shares were riding high on that, double-digit increases. Depends when you listen now, of course, yes. This podcast depends where they are, but they're looking very good. It's in the green, and very good in the green. Last time I looked, it was 22% up, so looking very good. So we'll go into the details of why the share price is reacting possibly. But before we do, as always, could you just change your name and your structure and your direction? Zoetic, just give us a summary as to what it's all about, please, Nick.
Yes, absolutely. So Zoetic International is a vertically integrated CBD business. So we grow hemp in Colorado, we process the hemp, we manufacture CBD, we manufacture our products, and we retail products as well. Historically, the company has an oil and gas business, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on in this discussion. We're looking to exit that and become a pure play hemp and CBD player.
Yeah, and because it's a very hot space, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest, around the world,
yes.
Everyone's seen,
yes,
the benefits of CBD. So like I said, nice detailed trading update. Start by taking us through some of the financials, if you could, Nick.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was a detailed update. I'd made a commitment to shareholders back in August that we'd put out a very detailed trading update at the end of our six-month period. I was also very clear we'd put in some financial information, which is probably a bit of a break from tradition for this company. And so, you know, just running through some of the key numbers, we have reported revenue of 1.15 million. That's sterling. Now, most of that revenue is in the oil and gas business, the historic business that I mentioned earlier we're looking to exit from in due course. But we started our CBD sales in the US right at the tail end of June, and we started CBD sales in the UK at the beginning of August. So what we're seeing is just the initial revenues coming through from that business. Mm-hmm. But really, the story is about setting up distribution channels and setting up retail stores. I was saying to a shareholder earlier this morning, you know, we're not market traders. We're building a brand. The objective in the first few months was not to generate an enormous amount of revenue. I mean, of course, revenue is good, but the objective is to generate the channels that we can then use to put the products through over the next few months. And hopefully what we demonstrated today is we've got some very strong channels, and I can talk more about that later. The other thing we're very keen to demonstrate with the financials is there's been a lot of talk in the market about, does this company need to do an emergency placing? Is the company running out of money? So I want to be very clear with investors. We have just over £1 million in the bank. We have an opportunity to recover performance bonds. We have a total of $360,000 of performance bonds in three states around the US, which we have a process to recover. We have $60,000 back already. We should get another $140,000 back before the end of the year. And also very significantly, we've had a long-standing debt owed to us by a company called Diversion. And again, I can talk in more detail later, but we've recovered $65,000 in cash from them and have also received back 950,000 shares, which we'll hold in treasury in satisfaction of part of that debt. So hopefully what investors can see is that the financial position of the company is far stronger than perhaps people initially thought. And then the last thing to mention, I mean, that's one thing to talk about, the cash we have, but also the costs. We have considerably reduced cost in the business. We've put in place a number of cost-cutting measures, and as those measures come through, we should be running at a pro forma operating expense of around about £2.5 million sterling per annum for the business, which again is dramatically lower than it's been in the past.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent stuff. So let's concentrate on the CBD business there, because you mentioned a lot of that revenue is from the oil and gas. So what are the key highlights here?
Well, I mean, the standout highlight is we've signed a distribution agreement with a US business called Mr. Checkout. Now, this is a business that manages distribution from the manufacturer straight to the retailer. They have associations with over 150,000 retail members. You know, this is an enormous opportunity for us. Now, we're starting out with an initial supply of 15 distributors, and assuming that works, then we start to have access to that, to more and more of their network. And we need to be realistic as to how many we're going to get. I mean, there's no prediction here that we're going to be in 150,000 stores. That is not the plan at all. But the plan is to get more involved with bigger distributors who can give us access to wider aspects of the US market. Mm-hmm. And for a company of our size, to be able to partner with a business of that size is really quite spectacular, particularly bearing in mind we're only 3 months into actually selling our products. But what we've got is a product formulation in the US, which has got people sitting up and taking notice. And that's why companies of the size of Mr. Checkout are showing interest in what we're doing. Over in the UK, Zoetic, or the CBD side of Zoetic, is quite different. Here we're marketing a more aspirational brand. We started out a couple of months ago selling CBD tinctures or CBD oils. What we've announced this morning is that we're moving into a line of cosmetics. We expect to have the first products out in the next few weeks, but most of the products out shortly before Christmas. We have it on the back of that, perhaps demonstrating that the cosmetic area is perhaps one of the biggest growth areas in CBD. We've signed a distribution agreement with a business in the north of England that is very keen to stock our products and to distribute them across that region. And then away from the brands, and arguably maybe the bigger part of the business, is the genetic side. We have been in the last few months working on producing feminized seeds, and I've probably said before in our conversations, but feminized seeds are important in hemp. This is a plant that grows in a male and a female variety, and it's only the female variety that has any meaningful yield. So our indoor facility is produces perfect conditions to create feminized seeds. We've been working on that over the last few months. We believe the project that we have is going to be successful. We believe we'll have our first seeds by the end of the year, which is absolutely perfect timing. The time to sell the seeds is as the growing season starts. And some of the southern states in the US will start buying seeds at the very beginning of 2020. And that buying period will run right through to probably late spring as hemp plants are put into the ground. So we're pretty optimistic. We should be producing a decent quantity of seeds. Yeah, that program will mature over the coming 6 months. But the indoor facility we have has four bays. Each bay, we think, conservatively, could do up to about 1 million seeds. And we should be able to harvest a bay once a month. And as I say, sales will always be attached to the growing seasons. They'll always be attached to that first quarter of the calendar year. But it looks to me like our project is coming to fruition just at the right time.
Yeah. Is there any way, what's the price of seeds then? Is there any way of working that out so people can try and work out
well,
the potential there?
The example I always give is this year we paid $1 per seed wholesale. Okay. I'm not a seed broker. I'd be sort of loath to start making projections. Mm. Yeah, and I'd also encourage investors to acknowledge that we as a company are not seed brokers, so we're going to need some assistance in selling the seeds. But what I have said in the past is even if the seed price halves, growing hemp plants to produce seed is going to be far more profitable than growing hemp plants to produce wholesale CBD. Mm-hmm. So this could be a very, very significant part of the business. I mean, I don't want people to doing the calculations of, one times a million equals $1 million of revenue every month. Yeah, that would be highly optimistic.
Yeah.
But we don't need that level of optimism. This is a business that I think if we get it right and we feel that our techniques are working well, this could be very significant for the company going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of me was hoping that Mr. Checkout was an American guy called Chuck, but I did realise it was a business, but I like the fact called Mr. Checkout. But, okay, so let's move on.
Sharp.
Say again.
Um, you, They appeared on Shark Tank, the American equivalent of Dragon's Den. That was how they got started.
Yeah,
and then they've grown from there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a very managed business.
Yeah, and Shark Tank, there's a lot more. Do you know what? You can times that by 10 on America. I mean, the money that goes around there is a lot bigger than over here on Dragon's Den. Okay, so let's go into the... I assume you're getting hassled. Hassled, that's a rude way of putting it. I assume you're getting queries on the oil and gas assets and how the sale is going for those or the process.
Yes, lots of inquiries as to how that's progressing. Again, what I've always said from the start is we're not rushing into anything. We're very determined to exit oil and gas, but we're not. This is not a panic sale. This is not a fire sale. We have been in the last few weeks since we announced our plan to exit. We've been working through the best way to realise value. There are two options. You know, one is to sell the entire package to one buyer, and the other, which is possibly a little bit more likely, is to split it up and to identify buyers who are going to be most interested in certain parts of the assets. We've had a number of conversations. We have two indicative offers already. Work needs to be done on those to see if this is something we want to proceed with, but that perhaps gives people confidence that these assets can be sold. And perhaps most importantly, we believe that once they're sold, we will settle out of the cash proceeds of that sale all of our liabilities. That includes the $500,000 debt facility we drew down. Yeah, and we will come out positive. Now, I always say that with a little bit of an apology to existing shareholders. I know a lot of people bought into this company under its previous name in the hope and the expectation the oil and gas business would be better than it has been. So I recognize there's some disappointment there. But at the same time, I think we'll be able to demonstrate to investors that the oil and gas side is perhaps better than people fear that it might be. It's not going to be tremendous, but it is going to generate or should generate positive cash flow once we're out of it and once we've settled the liabilities. Yeah, and a long, long way to go, but that is our target.
Excellent stuff. Can you take us through you mentioned a deal with Diversion there, which will bring in some cash. Can you explain that in a bit more detail, please?
Yes, Diversion is a company that is owned by Paul Mendel, our chairman, and also Robert Price, our former chairman and chief executive.
Yeah.
Some 4.5 years ago, Diversion sold a technology product to us called DT Ultravert, which is a well bashing and refracking technology.
Yeah.
Diversion owns 25% of that, and Zoetic International owns the balancing 75% of that technology. In the past 4 years, Zoetic has covered substantially all of the costs of developing the technology, such that as at the end of the last financial year, there was a debt of $125,000 due from Diversion to Zoetic for the cost of that development. What we've done today is Diversion has returned to us, or essentially we've agreed that we will buy back from Diversion 950,000 shares that Diversion owns in Zoetic International, and we will also receive from Diversion $65,000 of cash. And the combination of that buyback and the cash receipt will pay down, I think, substantially all of that debt. It gives Zoetic further cash. I mentioned earlier that it's important to demonstrate to investors that we can operate under our own steam and we can live within our means. So it's further cash in. We'll hold some stock in treasury, so it reduces the actual issued number of shares ever so slightly. But also it just tidies up the balance sheet a little bit, and it brings to an end a rather uncomfortable debt that we held through a sort of a related party arrangement with our former chairman and our current chairman.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all in all, very, very positive. And I really have to sort of say thank you to Paul Mendel for helping facilitate that transaction. It's really very much his work that has enabled us to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely marvellous stuff. Okay, well, the final thing, as always, Nick, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, please give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, the first reason is that the CBD market is very fast growing. I've talked about that on a number of occasions, and I hope what investors can see in today's announcement is that we are focused on putting our energies and putting our resources at the fastest growing and highest margin part of that business. And that means we're focused on seeds at the beginning of the process. We're focused on building good quality, recognized and respected brands at the end of that process. The second reason is again, I hope what we demonstrate in this morning's announcement is that our financial situation is somewhat better than perhaps investors gave us credit for. There's a long, long way to go, and I never want to sound like I'm sitting on my laurels. We know that we have an enormous amount of work to do. We need to sell the oil and gas side. We need to prove that the brands we think are good are indeed as good as they are. But what we think we've achieved so far is we've got that recognition, and we're putting our efforts where we think we can get the biggest return. And then the third area, not mentioned in this morning's announcement, but we do have a long-standing plan to list on the OTC in the US. That will give us access to a far larger market. It will enfranchise US investors who may wish to participate in the company. That process continues, as it's in the hands of the US regulator, but we have every reason and every expectation that it is something that we can conclude in the very near term. And you know, I'll be delighted to announce that once we've got the okay from the OTC.
Marvellous stuff. Nick, good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
I'll look forward to it. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me right now is Glenroy Goodman, Chief Crypto Trader. Do you know what? I used to work with a guy called Glenroy. I really like that, Glenroy. It's almost two names in one. Because some of the parents have said, our boy is so good, we're going to give him two names because he's better than most guys. So he's going to be called Glenn and Roy. Glenroy.
Yeah, you're kind of defying the whole point of why my parents called me Glenn. They had this idea that they hated it when people's names get shortened. Like, I don't know, do people call you Just or something like that? So they wanted a one syllable, something that people couldn't shorten. But then people just lengthen it my whole life. That's not the first time I've been called Glenroy.
Along with Glenith.
I get called Glenda.
Glenda, Glenith. Glenith. It's Kenneth, but Glenith. Glenith. Glenith Goodman.
I get Glenwood.
Glenwood, I like Glenwood, yes. Glenith. Right, Glenith. In the world of crypto, of course, just an introduction. You know, Glenn's on most weeks, apart from he goes on holidays, or I go on holidays. But he's now an author, a successful trader. Essentially, a successful trader off the back, and then you become an author off the back of that, of course, saying,
that's right,
this is how to do it. How is books go? Sales book going? Because I haven't received any commission checks at all. I don't know if it's...
Well, as I told you, because you're on the 0% commission plan, then your checks
might not be as regular. Oh, I didn't realise that. No, I didn't realise that. Can we up that to the... The point is
0.0001. Yeah. Then, yeah.
I wondered why I haven't received anything because I'm on the zero. Is that a popular plan? Do you promise that to lots of people? I'll put you on the 0% commission plan. It's
very
popular.
Everyone in the world is now on my 0% commission plan. The crypto trader is going very well. I am speaking at eToro shortly, and that will be an interesting one as well. Going to do a webinar and a live appearance, and they're giving away a bunch of my books to some of their trainees, which is nice as well. And then we've got the London Investor Show coming up in a couple of weeks, which I think I mentioned last week as well.
Cool. When a company does that, they give away some of your books. Do you have to give them those for free?
No, they bought them.
Oh, that's good,
isn't it?
I was going to say, it's like giving away your books.
They bought dozens and dozens of my books. They just bought them, paid good money for them,
yeah,
and then give them away to the trainee traders free.
Okay,
I'm going to sign them all, obviously, because people like signed books. A little special message.
Well, up the value or down the value? If they want to resell it,
Yeah, I don't know. Could be down, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Depends what quality pen I use, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. You got a fancy signature where you put your face in the middle of the G, maybe, with two eyes and a nose. It would work out. The nose, the G, would work out. The smile with the G and the round G, eyes in the middle, the G, the mouth would work out. That would look quite nice, I think.
All right, I'll try that.
And you've got to put the Bitcoin in there somewhere, haven't you? The logo of a B.
Oh, good point. Yeah. I said I don't have a B in my name. Yeah. But anyway, aside from my travails with trying to get a good signature, do you want to hear about what's been going on in
because it's the Bitcoin price. I'm looking at that. So I was looking at 68% now. Of the crypto market is Bitcoin, isn't it? I was looking at that. It's gone up to 71 at one point. It's down to 68. But it's still, flirting with that 200-day moving average. It doesn't seem to want to... It looks like to me that's the pretty much support or resistance line, doesn't it? It needs to move up to 8,500 at least to get above that and start moving north again. But at the moment, it's at 8,300, which is annoying. Just below that level, isn't it,
Yes, it is just kind of teetering on the brink of much worse falls that may or may not occur. It's, I mean, the chart at the moment, people are asking me, which way do you think it will go? It's one of those situations where it's where it literally could go either way. There's no kind of clear sign of where it's going to go next. So I'm out. I am, you know, I don't have any money in it, either long or short.
When you say
short
out,
at the moment.
You're out. You know, this is not, you know, you're talking about sexuality here. You're just talking about Bitcoin, yeah? It's a funny way to come out on a podcast. Just halfway through, you just go, I'm out.
It's a good time. I mean, this is as good a place as any to come out, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
And, I trust you implicitly. Yeah. I think you would be very supportive of my choice.
It's a very measured reveal, you know. I mean, you didn't actually say it in public, really. Sort of halfway through a podcast, you sort of, you know, put it into a Bitcoin speak and trading speak and say, I'm out. Didn't you? You said, I've said it on a podcast, I reveal it quite openly.
Yeah, it's the apt way for me to do it. But no, as for the price, yeah, as I say, so I'm, yeah, when I say I'm out, the sexual reveal will come at a later date. This is, I am out of Bitcoin right now, because you may remember, or avid listeners may remember, that Bitcoin had formed a triangle, what we call a descending triangle shape for 3 months, and me and Justin have been talking about it lots and lots. And we expected a strong breakout either upwards or downwards. You can never be sure, though the bias was for a downward breakout with this kind of triangle.
You said it was upwards, you said? You said it was a continuation pattern, you said.
I said that was one argument for why it might go upwards, but the fact that it was a descending triangle meant that the bias was down. But you're quite right. I said, look, we're still in an upward trend. Mm. So when you're in an upward trend, chances are it will break upwards, but it could break downwards because it's a descending triangle. I said that, Justin. I said it could go either way. Mm. So you can't catch me out.
I just did.
But, anyway, proof is in the pudding, right? Because when it did break downwards, I was ready for it, and I sold short. Yeah, I went short, and I made a lot of money selling short. So, you know, that's, as I think we've talked about before, I'm not the kind of trader who's in the prediction game. If it's going to break out, it'll break out upwards at this point, or it'll break out downwards at that point, and I'm ready to make money either way, kind of thing.
As long as you've got a plan, it's fine. Yeah. You know, you mustn't be stuck in your ways. And say, it's great. If you are a Bitcoin investor, I assume you're stuck in your ways. You'll say, it's going higher, it's going higher, it's going higher. And you could lose money in a short term there if you think it's going higher long term. But as a trader, you shouldn't take a stance, you know, on loyalty towards Bitcoin. You just go with the flow, you know?
Don't fall in love with your Bitcoin, as I said in the title of a chapter. Harriman House, who published my book, they're doing a kind of compilation of investment geniuses, each writing a chapter. And they've invited me to be part of it.
Were they short?
It's not called Investment Geniuses. It's just
Glenn was short of it. Give a fill-in for this guy.
There are a lot of authors in this book, let me put it this way. They're not short people.
I haven't had the call either.
Anthony Bolton. And people like that, you know, real clever guys. Anyway, they asked me because they needed a chapter on crypto. And obviously, it's harder to find somebody who's a genius about crypto. So they had to settle for me.
How did they pitch that to you? Did they say, listen, Glenn, we're doing a book on investment geniuses. We also want a chapter on crypto. Could you do that?
that was pretty much it. Yeah. You're like, you're our only option. So anyway, but one of the kind of subheadings that I put in that chapter was don't fall in love with your Bitcoin. And it's exactly what you're talking about. It's if you're a trader like I am, then it just does not make, well, actually, to be perfectly honest, I don't even think investors should fall in love with Bitcoin because we just don't know. We've talked about this before, but we don't know whether Bitcoin will end up being the Amazon of cryptocurrencies or the Netscape, you know, whether it'll be the Facebook or the MySpace. We just don't know. I mean, okay, it's got massive first mover advantage over other cryptocurrencies, but the disadvantage is that many of the newer cryptocurrencies have got much cleverer technology, and as a result, you know, there's a possibility that they could eclipse Bitcoin at some point, and everyone will go, oh, do you remember Bitcoin? That was funny, wasn't it? Oh, we don't really see that around anymore. So So yeah, I'm always ambivalent. And when Bitcoin was forming that triangle, I was ready for it to break upwards or break downwards, and I was ready to trade it either way and make money either way. As it is, it went down, so I made money from that short trade. I closed that short trade near the bottom of the trading range that we're currently in, and I am now just sitting on my hands and waiting for the next move, which I hope would be up. I hope, you know, I mean, I do hope that, because when something goes up, there's infinite upside, as we've said before. And when it goes down, there's only limited downside, you know, up to 100% is the most you can make, whereas infinity percent is how much money you can make if it goes upwards.
Yeah, well, listen, I wouldn't sit in your hands for too long, because you may lose circulation. When you go to put on a trade then, you may not be able to use your hands, you know? Just that kind of thing. That would be awful if your hands are just floppy and you can't actually do anything on the keyboard because you've been sitting on them for so long. So get your hands out, stretch them a bit every now and again. Get ready, just practice over the keyboard. You know, just,
I'm okay. I've got a bony bum, so it doesn't really stop the blood flow.
I thought you were going to use your bum then to type. Okay, so talking about Ray Dalio, weren't you, something?
Oh, yeah, Ray Dalio. I really wanted to mention this. You know, this is slightly after outside our usual comfort zone of just talking crypto, but I think it's really relevant. Ray Dalio, yeah. If you're not familiar with him, if anybody listening is not familiar with him, he is one of the world's biggest hedge fund managers,
yeah.
And one of the most influential thinkers on economics as well. He's written a bunch of best-selling books.
He's always quoted by CNBC and all those kind of people all the time, yeah. Isn't he? Whenever he says something,
he's quoted constantly. Because, I mean, look, I got to hand it to him. He is really clever. So when he wrote this great LinkedIn article, which you can easily find, it really kind of made an impact. And I thought, I've got to take this seriously. It was a kind of big think thing. So let me just tell you the basics of it. And this won't be the first time you've heard this theory, but he expands on it, is that we are living in a time that is quite similar, worryingly similar to the 1930s. That's obviously a theory that lots of other people have put forward, but his argument is this. Okay, so we've got the biggest gap between the rich and the poor, he says, since the 1930s, and this is creating a lot of populism on both the left and the right, and the left and the right populists are butting heads together, and there are various forms of warfare that are already underway. He's talking particularly with reference to the US and China coming up against each other. Obviously, the tariff war we already know about. He's also makes reference to a war, a technological war, a capital war, talking about the possibility of capital controls and cutting off capital flows to China, that kind of thing. And if the worst comes to the worst, an actual geopolitical war, which obviously we all hope will never happen. So that's kind of the backdrop to what he's talking about. And he says that it is now inevitable that, or more or less inevitable, that what is going to happen is we're going to move to an even more extreme form of monetary policy than we've seen already. So he outlines the three major types of monetary policy. Number one, the usual type where you just reduce interest rates. Number two, quantitative easing, which we have seen a lot of over the past decade or so, where money is effectively put from central banks, created by central banks, and put into high street banks and main banks, and the money finds its way to rich investors who then push the prices of stocks and shares and other assets upwards, which we've seen. But he says that because those two options are more or less used up, that they've interest rates are, you know, almost as low as they can go pretty much everywhere in the world. Quantitative easing is not very efficient if we start moving into a recession. He's saying next time we move into a recession, major governments will possibly have no choice but to do some kind of helicopter money, to basically just start printing money willy-nilly. And he's desperately hoping that they do this in a way that combines fiscal policy and monetary policy in a productive manner. But he's saying, you know, if the worst came to the worst, they would just print a ton of money and just hand it out to people to spend. And that is the key thing, is that as opposed to quantitative easing, where the money ends up in the hands of rich people, helicopter money would be all about stimulating the economy by basically just giving ordinary people a ton of money in some form or another and just saying, right, here you go, spend it, boost the economy, please. But as we know, the problem with that, of course, in historically, is that it can cause massive inflation and it can end up devaluing your currency. You know, your currency becomes worth less if you just print endless amounts of it. So these are kind of the worries that we have to take on board. And the way he describes it, it's really hard to argue with his thesis there. I mean, would you argue with that, Justin? Do you think it's unlikely we'd get that kind of helicopter money?
No, well, I think historically, if you look back, that's what's happened. It's inflation. You know, I did a video on why you should invest a while back for basic, you know, for people not investing in the stock. People who have spare cash, if you're keeping it in the bank, you are losing money. And on average, I think it's from 1985 or something. If you had 40 grand in a bank in 1985, and the inflation would have been, on average, run about 4% a year, it's been over that many years. So that buying power now is only worth 10 grand. So you've lost 30 grand. So, you know, and that's the way inflation happens. And it's always happened via, you know, interest rates or interest inflation or money printing. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to continue happening. You know, that kind of inflation is not going to stop, is it? And that's why gold and almost digital gold, which is now Bitcoin, should, you know, be a safe store. Because like Bitcoin and gold, both technically, you know, hardwired to only have a finite amount in circulation. So essentially, that should prevent them. That's anti-inflationary protection, you know? So,
What I was going to get onto, exactly that. I was going to suggest that that's why it's relevant for, you know, listeners of this show, apart from for general interest in our world in general. It kind of points in that direction, doesn't it? That cryptocurrencies and gold, and actually the kind of small shares that a lot of your listeners like to invest in, and the companies that you talk about, you know, if you do get into a high inflation environment, then the prices of stocks tend to go up enormously as well, in line with the kind of inflation and the possible devaluation of the native currency that you're investing in as well. And so those can be a good bet. Well, or not so much those can be a good bet. It's more like you almost have to put your money into shares because they're the only things that can protect you from high inflation if they are indeed rising. The worst thing you want, of course, is a situation like the 1970s, where, yeah, there were some periods where shares were rising very strongly, but then you'd get massive declines as well, even though inflation was rising massively. So it was an absolute nightmare time to be any kind of an investor. So we just have to pray that we don't get that kind of situation again. But yeah, in general, I would just make one caveat to what Ray Dalio said. And he doesn't really talk much about inflation. I'm talking here about inflation and how we could be pointing in certain directions. He doesn't really go into that side of things, but in the past decade, we haven't had inflation, have we? That's the kind of the bit which makes you think, but would it actually happen?
The figures they tell you about and the actual figures are completely different. There's an excellent book about how to buy the world I read about. And he says, basically, inflation is, you know, the governments skew inflation pretty much to what they want to say. The basket of stocks or the basket of goods they look at, of course, can be inaccurate. And there's different ways of measuring them. And he went into huge detail. I forget most of it now. But I thought, I didn't even think of that. And it's so obvious. He said, so real inflation is running about, you know, the Office of National Statistics said it's running on average about 4% a year. When, in fact, it's ridiculous because if you look at it, you know, it lasts 10 years, it's never been around but that. But it is. That's how it's worked. So inflation is, you know, happening all the time. We're told by the government, oh, it's running at 2%, our target rate. It's not. It's absolutely not. If you look back historically, it's running at a lot higher rate than we think, you know?
Well, because they changed from RPI to CPI. Well,
not only that, kind of but you get things like shrinkflation. You know, where you get consumer prices.
Oh, yes,
products reducing in size, but they almost put the price up a little bit, not as much as inflation. So the price of it is measured pretty much, but the size isn't, and all that kind of stuff. And lots
true.
Of things change.
I mean, and I do take your point about that. That's absolutely true. And plus, you can also make the argument that the inflation, rather than showing up in product prices over the past decade, has just shown up in the prices of assets like stocks and shares. That's where the money, you know, the money had to go somewhere, so it went there rather than into retail prices in general. But, you know, if you look all over the world...
Is it different now? If you go back, if you look back at historically about the last 100 years, it's happened and it's been running at a lot higher rate than the governments have told us. So I don't see it stop happening. It may temporarily desist for a little bit or slow down, but I think it, you know, as we know, reverts to mean. Or go, like, it's like a pendulum, isn't it? It'll go from one extreme to the other extreme and settle in the middle. But so we should say, if we've been under... You know, if inflation has been under target or below target, then surely there'd be a period of time where it becomes above target for a while, you know, and so it averages out, doesn't it? You know, so yeah. So I just think, anyway, assets like gold and digital gold, like Bitcoin, that's why I got into, you know, that's why I got exposure via Argo blockchain mining Bitcoin, because I just generally think Bitcoin should go higher in the long term. If it's, like I said, if its supply is finite, then it should go, and more people start using it, then it should go higher.
There is one quick story about exactly that I should mention, which is a large German bank has made a prediction that Bitcoin will go to $90,000 per Bitcoin in 2020.
Excellent. So, well, I clicked on that link and it was the wrong link. I looked for it. I saw the link on Twitter and I clicked on it. I read a lot of facts from the next network or something. Very good, actually. Yakamoto... some kind of bot who's got on a bit. Yeah, loads of facts on Bitcoin.
Yes,
it's very interesting.
If you scroll about a mile down that page, then you get to the bit I'm talking about. But because I saw that same, is it like a pretend Satoshi Nakamoto?
Nakaboto is called, yes. That's right. Nakaboto, he's a bot. But it's all loads of good stats in there. It was very impressive. But
anyways, here's what they're saying. I mean, you know, it's just one bank's opinion, and as we know, as many of us know to our cost, when major banks make predictions about asset prices, they're more often wrong than they are right. But let's take it with a pinch of salt. So they're saying 90,000. I mean, we're currently at a price of around about $8,000. So if it went to $90,000 next year, that would be absolutely amazing. But it wouldn't be the first time that Bitcoin has made a move like that. Now, the reason why they think this is because of the halving that you've referred to in the past, the halving of Bitcoin that is due to occur next year. And what that effectively means is that the amount of Bitcoin that's being produced every year is going to slow down considerably. So because of that, they're saying this will create a very high stock to flow ratio. Now, they believe that the price of gold is as high as it is because of the stock to flow ratio it being high. In other words, there's a lot of gold in existence, but not much more actually being created anymore compared to the amount that already exists. And so that means that, you know, because there's only a trickle of new gold coming out, therefore the price of gold stays at a relatively high level. And they're now saying that this will happen with Bitcoin, that Bitcoin will have a much higher stock to flow ratio once that halving occurs next year, the algorithmic halving that means that less new Bitcoin will come out. That means that there will be much more Bitcoin already in existence compared to the new amount coming out, and therefore that will provide a certain hardness to the price and put a kind of upward bias on the price. How they came to $90,000 as their estimate, I mean, you know, obviously they just plugged into their model of stock flow. What will Bitcoin do if gold has done this? And they came up with 90,000, which is all very well and good. But as I say, take it with a pinch of salt. But it's an interesting theory nonetheless.
Yeah, well, I'll sign up to that thought. Anyway, I'm happy with that because I'm exposed to Bitcoin. That's fine. Lovely. Glenn, listen, look how many books you'll sell then, Glenn. It'd be amazing.
So many
books. And my commission would be fantastic. Well, you know, in fact, about 100,000 times zero is still a zero, isn't it? Okay.
But it's better to have 100,000 zeros than just one.
Oh, I don't know. Okay, I don't know where to store them all. Glenn, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Good stuff.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Zoetic International. Zoe, of course, had Nick on the podcast. At four, Rehabil Resources, RBD. Just announced they may be doing a fundraise. At three, Bagir Group, up 15.3%. That's BAGR. At two, New Oil and Gas, NewOG. Number one is Metro Bank, of course, 2.41% down at the moment. Most followed again. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, BP, CEO Bob Dudley to retire. Bernard Looney succeeds. Looney succeeded Dudley. Wow. Polarin at four notes. Statement from Amphion Innovations. Of course, we talked about that in the podcast. Coro Energy. Tambak 2 Wellspud. At two, Ektek. Completion of maintenance contract with TMB. And number one, most liked harness, came from Zoetic International. Nick was in the podcast again, chatting about that. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.